Hello and welcome to our program, The Advocates. My name is Richard J. Garfunkel. I am the host of this weekly forum. The program is coming from Jupiter, Florida, in the studios of WJUP 103.9 FM. My guest is author and historian James Bradley. As I say each week, the mission of The Advocates is to bring to the public differing views on current public policy issues. Therefore, public policy is, what, as a nation, what we legally and traditionally follow. We also deal with current affairs and what's happening in the world. Welcome back, James Bradley, to The Advocates, and thank you for joining me once again.
Great to be here.
That's great. James Bradley is the fourth child of the Iwo Jima flag raiser, John Doc Bradley. He was raised in Wisconsin. He studied at the University of Notre Dame, Sophia University in Tokyo, Japan, graduated with a degree in East Asian history from the University of Wisconsin, the Badgers, as we know. He's the author of Flag of Our Fathers, Flyboys, The Imperial Cruise. His latest book, The China Mirage, The Hidden History of American Disaster in Asia, is his fourth book, and it details the America's involvement in China since the early 19th century, from the heights of the opium trade through the wars against Japan, Korea, Vietnam, and up till today. Mr. Bradley last visited The Advocates way back in June of 2010, almost 6 years ago. You know, from the time you learned that your father was a flag raiser on Mount Suribachi on the volcanic island of Iwo Jima, you became interested in the Far East. You've traveled and lived extensively there, having just returned from Hawaii, Hong Kong, Ho Chi Minh City, Bangkok, Singapore. And in 2010, 6 years ago, you wrote a very interesting and I would say a bit controversial, but very interesting book, The Imperial Cruise, which also sets the scene for your latest work, The China Mirage. With that background in mind, many young Americans had parents who fought in the Pacific during World War II or in the Korean and Vietnam Wars, but they've never been interested in Asia's past or present. James, therefore, with that reality in mind, what guided your future to engage so much in the history and the culture of the two major Pacific Rim powers?
Well, you know, there's just a big void between the United States understanding things across the Pacific and understanding across the Atlantic. It's not our fault. We're a Eurocentric country. My dad raised the flag in Asia, and post-World War II, I was lucky to go to university in Tokyo, Japan, the home of my dad's former enemy. And, you know, at that time, Japanese kids would turn around when they'd see me on the street. There weren't a lot of Americans over in Asia then. We weren't even allowed to go into China. I mean, the first course on Chinese language and history was in 1936. If you can imagine that, we've been studying Greek and Rome since the 1600s here, but 1936 was the first time we took a look at China. For almost 100 years of American history, it was illegal for someone like you and me, white people, to know a Chinese because they were barred from coming here. So, you know, I'd ask your listeners, just because of our backgrounds, think of 10 European cities. Now think of 10 Chinese cities. Can you name them? Mm. We just don't know those 10 cities. And even though the people in those 10 Chinese cities are going to be much more important to America's future than anybody living in Rome.
You know, there's no question, and times change, and unfortunately, most people live in three lives, the half the life of their parents, their own life, and half the life of their children, and they don't realize that as time goes on, nothing is particularly static. You know, The China Mirage, your book, demonstrates that the United States failed to understand Asian cultures, which led to poor decision-making by policymakers in the U.S. State Department, as well as by both President Theodore Roosevelt and even Franklin Roosevelt. Your book, The Imperial Cruise, demonstrates that President Theodore Roosevelt suggested that the Japan's Emperor Meiji institute a Japanese Monroe Doctrine. James, how did Roosevelt's idea, the first Roosevelt, of course, idea of a Japanese Monroe Doctrine for Asia affect the countries of the Pacific? And was it a mistake?
Well, it was huge. The key stone here is Korea. And Teddy gave Korea to the Japanese to play with. He didn't think they'd go any further. I mean, to give you an idea of how little this is known in this country, there's only one statue in downtown Seoul, Korea right now that's dedicated to an American civilian. And you might think it's President Truman because he ordered in the troops to help Korea. But no, it's a guy named Homer Hulbert. Homer Halbert was an advisor to the Emperor of Korea, and the Emperor of Korea realized Japan wanted to take him over, and he sends Homer Halbert to the White House to beg Theodore Roosevelt for Korea's independence. Roosevelt turns him aside and gives Korea to Japan, and today the Koreans honor the guy in downtown Seoul, Homer Halbert, who begged Theodore Roosevelt for Korea's independence.
Mm. You know, it's interesting. Backing up a bit before Theodore Roosevelt's diplomatic mission to the Far East in 1905, Western political and military experts were shocked by Japan's destruction of the Russian fleet by Admiral Togo in 1904. With that in mind, how did the Japanese victory in the Russo-Japanese War affect planners in the United States with regards to China and Russia?
Well, this is huge, because what was FDR's later problem with World War II in Asia? It was Japanese expansionism. And it was Theodore Roosevelt who in 1905 greenlit that Japanese expansionism onto the Asian continent by giving him Korea. Mm. I mean, as Roosevelt says in his own pen, and I document in his letters, he was representing Emperor Meiji secretly in negotiations because he believed that Japan would spread U.S. values. Mm. So Teddy greenlit the problem that FDR later had in Asia. Teddy miscalculated. He thought he could keep Japan on a leash.
Yeah, and it's interesting because the irony is that Japan never had natural resources, and even at the dawn of World War II, the country was basically starving. World War II and the other wars of aggression were really over natural resources, almost in the same way that Europe was. You know, would we have felt less threatened if Russia had won the Russo-Japanese War and China had been unified and it merged as a great imperial or totalitarian state? I mean, which was worse? Was it worse having Japan as this aggressor or these two giants as aggressors towards each other?
Japan wasn't seen as an aggressor by the United States. It was right. Wildly popular and approved. The Russians were seen as the root of all evil, and Japan was a dog on a leash that was going to bark for America. At least that's what Teddy thought.
So, in other words, the sense was, as you articulated and wrote in the Imperial Cruise, that Theodore Roosevelt looked at Japan as the tip of the spear of Western modernism. Would you say that was so?
Yes, sir. Yes, he. At that time, thought in terms of racial theories. I don't mean he was a racist. I mean he went to Harvard and Columbia, and they taught these racial theories, and he was convinced that Japan was different than the rest of Asia. They were wearing Brooks Brothers suits. They had railroads, and they were drinking wines, and they were emulating Western ways. Teddy thought that, as you said, Japan would be the spearhead for American civilization into Asia.
Yeah. You know, and generally speaking, going back a little bit, American other European countries have been sending missionaries to China for many, many years. And the European compound in Beijing had been famously under siege by Chinese revolutionaries known as the Boxers during the ill-fated Boxer Rebellion. James, please tell us who were the Boxers and what happened to them, and how did America react in the wake of their failed uprising?
Well, it was all of one piece. I mean, the Boxers were revolutionaries. You're talking about the Chinese Civil War, the biggest war of the 19th century. But, in the China Mirage, I don't even put the Boxers in the index, because the China Mirage is really more about what happened in the American mind, what happened in Washington. I mean, on page 38 of the China Mirage, I have a drawing, and what it is the Statue of Liberty in the 19th century holding a baby, and the baby was China. Mm. And this was the China Mirage. We believe that the Chinese wanted to become Americanized and Christianized just like us. And we based policies on that, I think, up until today.
Mm. And it's interesting the way you bring that out, because of one of the leading publishers in America in the 1930s was Henry Luce, who founded Time Life Publishing Empire. Pearl Buck, a best-selling author in the 1930s, wrote extensively about China, and they were both children of American missionaries in China. And of course, Pearl Buck's books were made into movies. There was a tremendous amount of cultural interchange. How did these individuals influence American public opinion about China, and were they wrong or right?
Well, I'll let your listeners decide. I mean, the China mirage is this bamboozling idea fed to Americans that China wanted to be Americanized and Christianized. So here's a quote from Pearl Buck speaking to a university audience. The Chinese make good Christians not because they get converted from anything to anything, but because the extreme good sense, as expressed in the Golden Rule, which is the basis of Christianity, the product of another old race, is natural to the Chinese. Henry Luce is the number one publisher of the 1930s, and he says in a speech, "When the Christian prayer first came to China, the humblest farmer instantly understood it, so like it was his, our Father who art in heaven." China has embarked upon a vast reformation inspired by the Christian gospel. I mean, he was just talking nonsense. Pearl Buck was preaching nonsense to university students, again, whose parents had never been to China. They hadn't, no one had was going to see the reality on the ground. So this China mirage in the United States and the American mind dictated how we thought about China, and it was a myth.
Well, you know, it's interesting because there was the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882. And of course, that was quite racial based. And later on, there was a not as what would be defined as Japanese Exclusion Act in 1907. It wasn't articulated that way. How do you describe that juxtaposition between the public supporting Chinese and, in fact, Asian or exclusion acts and their idea that these people would be ripe for Western culture? How do you reconcile that?
I don't. And it's one of the stunning things. That's why I called the book The China Mirage. Americans, by law, did not want an Asian living next to us. Absolutely. We didn't want to sit in a church pew with an Asian, but we believe stories from the pulpit that those Asians over there, they want to be just like us. So I guess we were going to get more comfortable with China when they had McDonald's and freeways with our signs.
You know, it's interesting, and I know we're going to go in the later parts of this broadcast and some of the other details about how you regard missteps in foreign policy. But jumping quickly ahead, we have a few more moments in this segment. You know, there's been a lot of personal recrimination over the Japanese internment. Many people regard it as Roosevelt's greatest mistake. There was a problem, of course, Japanese, certainly a decently sizable Japanese population in both Hawaii and California. Interestingly enough, from my perspective, wasn't there an attitude in the American public reflective of the Japanese invasion of Manchuria and later the rape of Nanjing, a great fear that fed on the racial animus? Is that part of it too, that led to this fear of Japanese fifth column activity in the West Coast?
Oh, definitely. And I was fanned. The Japanese were the favorite Asians of the Teddy Roosevelt time. And then that changed when they went out of Teddy's boundaries. Teddy opens the door to Korea, and they said, "We want to eat more. You can't slap our hands down when we're finally up at the table. We want dessert, too." So they expanded into Manchuria in China, and this was Teddy's big mistake. The China lobby, established in the United States in the 1930s, beat the drums that, hey, look at those Japanese. They're, you know, horrible militarists, where we want to be just like you. We're just trying to be little Democrats, and if you just give us another $1 billion, things will be fine.
And, of course, just to give, James, give people some of the background of what we know Japan as almost a unified, homogeneous state with an emperor and an emperor god kind of concept. Give us a background before we get into our segment of what China was about, whether, you know, how disunified it was. Give us some idea of what China was in the early part of the 20th century.
Well, before that, 200 years before, it was the richest, highest tech country in the world. I mean, when the Parisians were digging roots out of the ground and living in mud huts, they were reading books off of printing presses, using money and fine silks. In the 1600s, China was the richest country in the world, and that changed with opium. That the number one trade of the 18th to 19th century, the number one trade in terms of value was opium. And great British fortunes, Harvard, Princeton, Yale, Columbia, great fortunes here. The grandfather of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Warren Delano, was the opium king of China. And these great fortunes sucked silver out of China, and you know, farmers couldn't pay their taxes, inflation whipped the country. There was a huge civil war and disorder until Mao put China back together and kicked the foreigners out.
So in other words, China was, one could see, a fragmented society of people of different backgrounds, stretching all the way from the Pacific coast all the way basically to Tibet, more or less. The road structure was primitive. The governmental structure was primitive. This was probably not different from a lot of other countries. Once you get along away from the cities and into the interior, it was pretty primitive, wouldn't you say, especially in the years leading up to the 20th century?
I would, but again, I want to de-emphasize what was happening in China because it didn't matter.
Yeah.
What was happening in the American mind was coming from church pews.
Yeah.
You got your China hit every week from your pastor and from the missionaries, and what they told you was that for just a few $1,000s more to build this church wall and put up this crucifix, China is coming our way.
Yeah.
This is a huge thread that goes through everything from the most sophisticatedly educated people in the State Department down to, down to the common labor, that this was the propaganda that we bought, that China wanted to become just like us.
You know, before we hear a word from our sponsors, this is The Advocates with Richard J. Garfunkel on WJUP 103.9 FM radio in Jupiter, Florida. I've been talking to my guest, author James Bradley, of Flag of Our Fathers fame and his latest book, The China Mirage, and we've been discussing his views on China and the mistakes American made in our view of that vast country, vast powerful country. We'll be back in a few seconds. Welcome back to The Advocates with Richard J. Garfunkel and WJUP 103.9 FM radio in Jupiter, Florida. I've been talking to author James Bradley about his views on China, his remarkable book, The China Mirage, which breaks a lot of myths about China and our relationships. James, after years of debilitating civil war and the overthrow of the Manchus, the last imperial dynasty, Sun Yat-sen and the Nationalist Party emerged as China's new leaders. James, who was Sun, and what was his role in the transition from an imperial society to what we would think as more modern China?
Well, Sun was, according to FDR, in the book, on page 294 and 295, there's pictures of FDR examining a new stamp. And it's a stamp with two people's pictures, Abe Lincoln and Sun Yat-sen. So he was the Abe Lincoln, the George Washington of China. And on the stamp that FDR commissioned, it said, of the people, by the people, for the people. And this is what I mean by the China Mirage. Mm. Franklin Delano Roosevelt was convinced that this stamp was accurate. Sun Yat-sen was going to bring an Abe Lincoln-like democracy to China.
Mm. Well, do you think it was also part of an idea of encouraging belief that this was the turning corner? Maybe he didn't really buy into it, but remember, maybe the symbolism of this was part of the strategy of consolidating support for China versus Japan. Could that have been part of the mindset?
Possibly, but we don't. You know, we don't dance around it when he says, here's a new deal and here is you know, we're declaring war. We take him at his word. I mean, as I document, Roosevelt got up in a national press conference and said China is more like the American democracy than any other country in the entire world. So he was very out there promoting the idea that China was this democracy, and that was one of the big shocks when Mao rose. Franklin Delano Roosevelt had told us that there was going to be a Christian China.
Well, it's interesting that, you know, we see mistakes and even mistakes from great leaders. You know, from the demise and overthrow of the Manchu dynasty until the death of Sun Yat-sen in 1925, China seemed to be on its way to some modernity and stability. This may be an illusion or, as you say, a mirage. What was Sun's connection with the Sung family, and how influential was that family with America and Franklin Delano Roosevelt? That's the critical element here. I think you've been trying to make a point about who were these new nationalists, and who were the Sungs?
Well, listeners would know the name Madame Chiang Kai-shek. She was actually Mei Ling Song, last name S-O-O-N-G, and some other, more listeners might know the three famous Song sisters, Mei Ling, Ai Ling, and Qing Ling. Well, two of the sisters, Mei Ling and Ai Ling, were allied with Chiang Kai-shek and were allied with the United States. Qing Ling went with Mao. In the 1970s, Zhou Enlai gave Qing Ling a vast, beautiful home in Beijing that's still preserved. I was there a few weeks ago. So Qing Ling and Mao were the ones that won.
Now, they met with Madame Chiang Kai-shek had a great deal of influence, and she went to school here. Of course, I believe she went to Wellesley. I'm not insanely positive.
Yes, sir.
That.
Wellesley, and Wellesley, among other schools,
and one of the finest women's colleges in America. What was her connect? I know they had photographic sessions and meetings with President Roosevelt. What was his thinking about Chiang, with all the advice given him that really was anti-Chiang? There were a lot of people here that understood that Chiang was less than met the eye. How did Roosevelt deal with them personally? Was he charmed by Madame Chiang Kai-shek?
He was definitely charmed, but it's much more than that. He, again, let's go back to the United States. Roosevelt is dealing with a populace that is 85% supporting the China mirage, the China lobby propaganda that the Song family is paying for. He's a vote getter. He's president of the United States. He has to get elected before anything else. And one of the things on his menu was this China mirage that Americans believe that China was about to go democratic. And he continued to foster that line. Yeah. And that was a line that was just a myth. China was not moving to democracy, but Roosevelt hoped it was.
Well, you know, also, just to digress a second, you know, we also looked at the Soviet Union during the Second World War with a much more positive perspective, knowing how critical they were as an ally. And, of course, later on we realized that, you know, maybe this was not the most genuine perspective about the Soviet Union in the least. But I do think that politics make strange bedfellows, and certainly I think the United States wanted to invest more in Chiang than Mao, reflective of, you know, the communist versus capitalism. What was let's go back a little bit on FDR's connection to China. Who was Warren Delano? You mentioned him as the Opium King. What did Warren Delano do to be the Opium King? What was that kind of business in those days?
Warren Delano was a blue blood from the East Coast. His father knew boats and hauling and you know, British naval tradition. And to seek his fortune, he went over and worked for the Russell Company out of Hong Kong and Macau and Canton. Russell and Company was the America's biggest opium dealer in China, and it was minting fortunes. I mean, if you go to Skull and Bones at Yale campus, that's supported by the Russell Trust. That's opium money. If you go to Columbia University in New York and you look at the biggest building, the most famous one, it's the Lowe Library. Well, Mr. Lowe made an opium fortune. He was a partner with Warren Delano. So again, Princeton is on land that was brought by opium barons. We have washed out of American history the enormity of the American wealth that was generated by this illegal trade.
You know, a lot of people in America still know the name Chiang Kai-shek. He lasted a long time. He was the leader of Taiwan after the nationalists were thrown out of China in 1949. He was Sun's nominal successor and eventually became the longtime leader of the nationalist Kuomintang. Who was Chiang and where did his power emanate from? I mean, was he just another warlord who was well connected? Or how did he assume the reins of Sun Yat-sen and the ear of President Roosevelt and many others?
He got his power from Henry Morgenthau's tax money, really. Chiang Kai-shek was the one dictator that we financed, that we gave arms to, that we paid his bills. And again, the Song family, which married around Chiang Kai-shek and surrounded Chiang Kai-shek and represented Chiang Kai-shek to the United States, they had all gone to school at America's best schools. And sometimes their English was better than their Chinese. And they knew the China Mirage. They knew what leaders like Roosevelt believed, and they encouraged this with the help of Henry Luce, Time Magazine, Pearl Buck, a number of Confederates. They created this image that Chiang is the guy who's going to lead China to become Americanized and Christianized, and Chiang got our support. This became a pattern. We put Syngman Rhee, a Christian, as the leader of South Korea, and he hadn't even lived there for a couple decades. We then supported President Diem in Saigon. Imagine Eisenhower chose a Catholic to be president of a 96% Buddhist country.
So in other words, what we're seeing is that in the United States, from generation to generation, president to president, from literally Theodore Roosevelt, who expands our influence with the imperial cruise, up through John F. Kennedy, the Diem family, we're seeing that on one hand we're anti-colonialist, we're anti-European colonies and their influence, and on the other hand we're investing in certain groups in these countries to be our ally in the future. Was this a mistake in regards to not dealing with the indigenous population and seeing what they wanted? Or we were too fearful of communism? How do you look at this choice between one poison or the other?
Well, I look at it that we were a Eurocentric country who wasn't breaking things down. I mean, we didn't start learning about China in our universities till 1936. When we went into Vietnam, there were almost no, I wonder if there were Vietnamese language classes at the university down the street from you. Right. I'm sure there wasn't. We didn't know anything about Asia. So when we dealt with Vietnam, we dealt through Paris. When we dealt with Indonesia, Dutch East Indies, we dealt through Holland.
Right.
And so were we anti-colonialists? Well, we certainly went out and fought for the interest of the colonials. They were our surrogates. We put the Dutch back into the Dutch East Indies after Japan was defeated. MacArthur said in Tokyo Bay, you know, democracy is rising over Asia, but we helped install the British and the French back to their colony.
Well, one thing for sure is FDR was an anti-colonist and an anti-colonial, and after his death and his promises to Ho Chi Minh to not back the French and call for unification of Vietnam, that was ignored. And in a sense, one of the great tragedies is that retreated almost back to the culture of and the alliances that had led to the First World War and the Second World War. You know, before we hear a word from our sponsors, this is The Advocates with Richard J. Garfunkel and WJUP 103.9 FM, Radio in Jupiter. I've been talking to my guest, author of Flag of Our Fathers, a great book, very interesting. I met him a number of years ago doing a lecture on it in Westchester County, and his latest book, The China Mirage and America's Role in the Emergence of China. We're going to be back in a few seconds with another section with James Bradley. Welcome back to The Advocates with Richard J. Garfunkel on WJUP 103.9 FM radio in Jupiter, Florida. I've been talking to my guest, author James Bradley. He's written four very interesting books. I have all of them. I've had a great deal of pleasure learning things from James Bradley. He has a lot of experience in the Far East, a place where it seems the future is. You know, there are a lot of people in the Far East. There are a lot of customers. There are a lot of suppliers. And there's going to be a lot of interaction with the Far East, whether we like it or we don't like it, over the next decades. You know, James, in your book, you seem to believe the United States made a strategic mistake with their involvement with the China lobby, and you've discussed a bit of it. I want you to go into a little more detail and depth of it. Who was the China lobby, and how did they wield such profound influence? Was it through the churches or the books? You mentioned a few people. Who else?
Well, it's the core of it is the Song family, who goes to school in the United States and says, hey, Americans believe this myth about China that it's going to be Americanized. And they support every organ that supports that. They established China lobby offices two blocks from New York's public library in Manhattan, pricey retail stuff. They get Henry Stimson, the former Secretary of State and Secretary of War, as their front man. And you're talking about radio commercials and professionally produced pamphlets and that went to every senator, went to opinion makers, newspapers, magazine people all across the country. The China lobby blanketed the country with this propaganda that the problem was if we just stop supporting Japan with oil and steel, Japan's going to withdraw and this democracy is going to bloom in China. It was a myth, but it got us down the road to World War II.
Yeah. You know, historically, and you bring up Henry Stimson, Manchuria had been invaded by Japan in 1931, and the Stimson Doctrine, of course, initiated by Hoover's Secretary of State, Henry L. Stimson, basically stated America would never recognize territory seized by another country by force. That doctrine would be reinforced by Japan's later invasion of China in 1937, the horrific rape of Nanjing, FDR's quarantine speech, and the Sumner Wells Doctrine of 1942. Certainly there was a tremendous level of sympathy for China and renewed hatred of the Japanese even before Pearl Harbor. You know, this rape of Nanjing was one of the great horrors of maybe the 20th century. What were the political pressures on FDR by the China lobby? Who was starting to align themselves with that? Was it only the churches or was it others?
A Gallup poll said that 85% of Americans had been convinced of the China lobby line that we could cut Japan's oil and there would be no recrimination. Everything would be fine. Democracy would rise in China. And you see in the book, even Eleanor is pestering him in his bedroom, you know. Franklin, why don't you just stop selling Japan oil? But Roosevelt told Churchill, there won't be a war in the Pacific because I'm appeasing Japan with oil. Mm. We sell Japan 85% of their oil. They'll never attack us if I continue that spigot. Mm. What I didn't know till I wrote this book is Roosevelt did not know for 1 month that China lobbyists in his own administration had cut Japan's oil. Mm. Hirohito in Tokyo is being warned, we're going to be an industrialized beached whale. We have to strike out. Roosevelt is singing hymns with Winston Churchill up in Canada and does not know that his administration cut the oil.
Yeah, but interestingly enough, China still was a very, very virulent aggressor in China by the time oil was cut off and scrap metal. Remember, they were shipping over metal from the 6th Avenue L in New York was going there. So the question wasn't the Roosevelt administration caught between a rock and a hard place? If they continued to send oil to Japan and scrap metal, they weren't really appeasing them because they were using that to fuel their military engine. If you cut them off, then you take the chance of starving them. So it was a, it was almost like a a Hobbesian choice. You know, it was a situation where it was, you know, very, very difficult to figure out policy. You know, in the period.
Okay, but Richard, can I interrupt for a
second?
Sure,
go ahead.
Those are hypotheticals. Let's just get down to what FDR believed and how he got stabbed in the back. FDR told Churchill, told the cabinet, told the American people, it's all documented in the China Mirage, that you got to understand, I'm appeasing Japan with oil. I'm keeping peace in the Pacific. He was planning for war in the Atlantic. He told Churchill, we don't need plans for war in the Pacific. There will be no war. So he has guys who disobey him, cut the oil, and we were surprised by Pearl Harbor.
Mm. Yeah, if you
watch documentaries on the Roosevelt, Richard, we're going to church with Churchill, and then, oh, surprise, the Japanese attack. It was a surprise. Roosevelt said, if we cut the oil, we're going to be in trouble. Oil was cut without his knowledge.
Well, it's in a sense, you know, I want to get on to the idea of we definitively thought that the Japanese were going to be aggressors, and we had a sense of it. You know, of course, Hawaii was on war alert on November 1st, 1941. That didn't prevent the Japanese from attacking, but it certainly prevented the United States from dealing with the element of surprise. Getting on to the period of America's emergence into World War II, there was an ongoing Chinese civil war between the nationalists and the communists. When Mao Zedong won the Chinese Revolution in 1949, many in the U.S. were surprised that Chiang Kai-shek was beaten. How did the China lobby obscure to the American public's the realities that existed in China, that the nationalists weren't that strong, that really didn't have the people? Wasn't the whole country, years after the Roosevelt time, sort of surprised how really weak Chiang Kai-shek was?
Yes, sir. And this is, again, the title of the book is The China Mirage. Here, Roosevelt, Henry Luce, Pearl Buck, the biggest thinkers and speakers of the 1930s and 40s said, Chiang Kai-shek, look, here's a picture of him in Life magazine holding a Bible. They would talk about going to church. Mei Ling Song would write articles about, you know, praying to the Lord. Mm-hmm. These are people who lived on top of dungeons where their political prisoners lived. There was nothing Christian or democratic about them, but the China Mirage held that for just a few billion dollars more, you're going to have Vermont-style democracy in China, and people are going to be going to church basements and having potluck dinners. I don't mean to sound so ridiculous about this, but that's how ridiculous it was. So there's a tsunami happening. It's called Mao. People in China are like, wow, Mao's going to win. But the United States is denying it, and we support Chiang to the end. Mm. And then we make a great decision. We got this natural phenomena called Mao, who's got the majority of Chinese people on his side. I mean, Chiang Kai-shek is kidnapping his soldiers. Peasants are walking over the mountains to get to Mao. And America doesn't realize this because we're reading Time magazine and listening to Pearl Buck, and then we're shocked in 1949 when the tsunami hit.
Well, it's interesting that nobody learned their lesson. Of course, the Republican Party used it as late as 1952 and in almost 1960, the idea of who lost China. But it's also interesting that Eisenhower, JFK, LBJ, and the Republican Party and the conservatives in this country to a degree supported Diem and the illusion that the South Vietnam was some alternative to the nationalist impulses of the Vietnamese people, that in a sense nobody learned their lesson. Certainly backing Diem, who was a northerner, he was from Hanoi. He wasn't a Southerner. He wasn't part of the irony was Ho Chi Minh was from the Iron Triangle and the Saigon area where all the farmers were and looked for assistance from the West and then turned to Russia. You know, it's nice to look back with hindsight on the foibles and the frailties of all our leaders. You know, before we hear a word from our sponsors and go into our last segment, this is The Advocates with Richard J. Garfunkel on WJUP 103.9 FM radio in Jupiter, Florida. I've been talking to my guest, James Bradley, the author of Flag of Our Fathers, a wonderful book, as we all know, and his newest book, The China Mirage, The Emergence of China. He's been giving us a lesson on mistakes that we should learn. You know, eventually we should learn some of these, lessons. It doesn't seem it sinks in. I'll be back in a second or so. Welcome back to The Advocates on February 28th with Richard J. Garfunkel on WJUP 103.9 FM radio in Jupiter, Florida. I've been talking to my guest, author James Bradley, about China, the mistakes America made regarding China's the policy, the influence of the China lobby, the two Roosevelts, the problems that came after it. You know, what I have learned from the Chinese mirage and from views of my guest, author and historian James Bradley, is that we should learn something from the lessons of the past and therefore not make the same mistakes again. Of course, we seem as a society, maybe a lot of societies do that. You know, what do they say about generals fighting the next war with the tactics of the last? Get it going back a bit now in history. With that in mind, James, what did Theodore Roosevelt mean by Japan is playing our game?
Again, the China mirage, the idea that there were forces that were going to be Americanized and Christianized. In Teddy's time, he believed that Japan was going to be the great holder of the American democratic and Christian banner. And that's why he allowed Japan to take Korea, because they were playing our game. Later, the Japanese became unpopular and FDR switched allegiances to China, but it was with the same goal. China would be democratized and Christianized if we just supported Chiang Kai-shek.
Mm. Is this this paradox, one could call it, or of who to back, which horse is ahead? Is this an innate lack of understanding of our actual power, our actual influence? And the fact that these are large population areas with their own desires and interests. Is this something that we keep on repeating, these mistakes? What do you think?
Yes, sir. And it's, you know, if Lyndon Johnson, I mean, Harry Truman, Dwight Eisenhower, and John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson, they were making decisions about China based on theories, the domino theory. The domino theory was a theory about China, and guess what? It was wrong. Mm. Guess what? Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, they didn't have anyone they could call up within their this wonderful American huge government. Hey, can you speak Chinese? No, we fired everyone who ever met Mao. Mm. We had Chinese speakers who knew Mao, who could have dealt with China, could have told us the truth, but we fired them all, and we had a State Department where nobody spoke any of these languages.
Mm. You know,
we would never deal with France that way. You know, Franklin Delano Roosevelt went to Europe like 14 times in his youth. He knew what the difference between a German and a Belgian and a Frenchman.
Yeah.
But we didn't know differences in Asia, but yet we put more military power in Asia than we did anywhere else in the world.
Mm. You know, we had a general that's quite well known to your father's generation and maybe some older people like myself in this country, named Vinegar Ben. It was his nickname, General Joe Stilwell, a tough guy. He had a very poor opinion of Chiang Kai-shek, and he paid for it. Why did people not listen to Stilwell, and what was his perspectives on Chinese strength and resistance against the Japanese?
So here you have a perfect illustration of the China mirage. Stilwell comes from a country, the United States, where 85% of the populace is propagandized by this China lobby myth that China's about to become democratized and Christianized. He goes to China and he writes in his diary, what will the Americans ever say when they learn the truth? Well, that bomb exploded in 1949 when Mao rose and we saw Chiang had a house of cards. There were a number of Americans who said Chiang Kai-shek is the past and Mao's the future. They were American military people who were out there on the front lines, and they saw Mao's attraction to the average Chinese. But that wasn't allowed to get into Fortune magazine or Time magazine or Life magazine or Pearl Buck speeches.
Mm. Yeah, interesting. You know, Claire Chennault, the commander of the AVC, American Volunteer Group, or Flying Tigers, as many people know it, wrote to FDR that Japan can easily be defeated with air power. Did FDR really believe that, and is there a connection to today's American drone campaign in the Middle East? Would you say that?
FDR took personal control of this secret air war in Asia. I mean, FDR is the, Roosevelt scholars are fascinated about this in the book, that he originated the domino theory in the 1940s that was later used in Vietnam. FDR, before Pearl Harbor, approved secret air war in Asia. I mean, this covert move had huge effects. It helped tip Japan into World War II. And this later morphed into an enormous CIA operation called Air America, the CIA's massive covert bombing of Asia that helped precipitate the Vietnam War.
Mm. Well, it's interesting how the geopolitics of that, you know, of 1930s, the era of totalitarianism, morphed into foreign policy in the post-war era. You know, we know, anybody who has a half a wit about them knows that democracy seemed to fail in the decline of the empires after World War I, the four great empires, the Ottomans, the Hohenzollerns, the Habsburgs, and the Romanovs, and this vacuum that was filled with, you know, temporary democracies, almost you could call them. They basically fell apart. And we found with ourselves facing the rise of dictators, both in Europe, where we were Eurocentric, as you said, and in Asia, obviously, with Japan. What's the answer to this as a pretty cogent observer of this type of history? What's our answer?
Well, I think the answer is this. I mean, I'm up in New York. A New Yorker would never allow someone from New Orleans, a councilman from New Orleans, to come up to New York and be mayor of New York. It'd be ridiculous. You've got to know New York 20, 30, 40 years before you could be the mayor of New York. I mean, the people of New Orleans would never import someone from Madison, Wisconsin, no matter how brilliant he was, to run the city of New Orleans. It's a totally different situation. So domestically, we believe in these regional targeted approaches. Internationally, we sit down in Washington and talk to a lot of people who look like us and come up with theories.
Mm.
The problem is we put military might behind those theories, and then millions of people die and 10 years go by, and then we say, gee, we made a mistake.
Right.
But,
yeah.
You know, come with me to Laos. One-third of Laos is littered with American bombs.
Yeah.
They're making paths through the bomb fields that you can walk on, and they have warning signs. You step off the path,
you're in trouble,
and you might get blown up by an American bomb.
Would you say that, in conclusion, we're running down to our last 30 seconds or so, would you say that it probably the best policy is to stay out of civil wars?
Yes, sir, but I would stay out of things we don't know much about.
Right.
I mean, are there a lot of good, a lot of people who know ISIS real well, have good intelligence advising the president, or are we just up 30,000 feet and bombing?
Mm.
Well, we've tried that a lot, and it hasn't worked.
Well, you know, it's very interesting. Hindsight is 20/20. We're running down in time. Unfortunately, it's been a great and informative hour, and I want to thank you for joining me again after all these years, and keeping so active as you have done. Thank you, James, for coming on.
You're welcome, and thanks for having me, Richard.
It's always a pleasure to have smart people and listen to different ideas. Thank you very much, James Bradley. Maybe later in the year we'll get you back to see what's happening in the in that part of the world you understand best. Thank you again. If you want to if you want to hear this broadcast or any of the other archived Advocate broadcasts, you can access them on my website, www.theadvocatesradio.com, where information on all my guests will be posted. Thank you and have a great day, James. And I know you're taking a train into New York today. Stay well. Okay. Be well.
I'm going to run. Thanks, Richard.
Be well. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.